Chapter 25. We had no need of hiring the country boats which ply on the Mahmoudia Canal to Atfa, where it joins the Nile, but were accommodated in one of the Peninsular and Oriental Company's fly boats, pretty similar to those narrow Irish canal boats in which the enterprising traveller has been carried from Dublin to Ballinasloe. The present boat was, to be sure, tugged by a little steamer, so that the Egyptian canal is ahead of the Irish in so far. In natural scenery, the one prospect is fully equal to the other. It must be confessed that there is nothing to see. In truth, there was nothing but this. You saw a muddy bank on each side of you, and a blue sky overhead. A few round mud huts and palm trees were planted along the line here and there. Sometimes we would see, on the water side, a woman in a blue robe, with her son by her, in that tight brown costume with which nature had supplied him. Now, it was a hat dropped by one of the party into the water. A brown Arab plunged and disappeared incontinently after the hat, reissued from the muddy water, prize in hand, and ran naked after the little steamer which was by this time far ahead of him, his brawny limbs shining in the sun. Then we had half-cold fowls and bitter ale. Then we had dinner bitter ale and cold fowls, with which incidents the day on the canal passed away, as harmlessly as if we had been in a Dutch tragship. Towards evening we arrived at the town of Atfa, half land, half houses, half palm trees, with swarms of half-naked people crowding the rustic shady bazaars, and bartering their produce of fruit or many-colored grain. Here the canal came to a check, ending abruptly with a large lock. A little fleet of masts and country ships were beyond the lock, and it led into the Nile. After all, it is something to have seen these red waters. It is only low green banks, mud huts, and palm clumps, with the sun setting red behind them, and the great, dull, sinuous river flashing here and there in the light. But it is the Nile, the old Saturn of a stream, a divinity yet, though younger river gods have deposed him. Hail! O venerable father of crocodiles! We were all lost in sentiments of the profoundest awe and respect, which we proved by tumbling down into the cabin of the Nile steamer that was waiting to receive us, and fighting and cheating for sleeping berths. At dawn in the morning we were on deck. The character had not altered of the scenery about the river. Vast flat stretches of land were on either side, recovering from the subsiding inundations. Near the mud villages, a country ship or two was roosting under the date trees, the landscape everywhere stretching away level and lonely. In the sky in the east was a long streak of greenish light, which whitened and rose until it grew to be of an opal color, then orange. Then, behold, the round red disk of the sun rose flaming up above the horizon. All the water blushed as he got up. The deck was all red. The steersman gave his helm to another, and prostrated himself on the deck, and bowed his head eastward, and praised the maker of the sun. It shone on his white turban as he was kneeling, and gilt up his bronzed face, and sent his blue shadow over the glowing deck. The distances, which had been gray, were now clothed in purple, and the broad stream was illuminated. As the sun rose higher, the morning blush faded away, the sky was cloudless and pale, and the river and the surrounding landscape were dazzlingly clear. Looking ahead in an hour or two, we saw the pyramids. Fancy my sensations, dear M colon two big ones, and a little one, ! There they lay, rosy and solemn in the distance, those old, majestical, mystical, familiar edifices. Several of us tried to be impressed, but breakfast supervening, a rush was made at the coffee and cold pies, and the sentiment of awe was lost in the scramble for victuals. Are we so blasés of the world, that the greatest marvels in it do not succeed in moving us? Have society, Pall Mall clubs, and a habit of sneering, so withered up our organs of veneration, that we can admire no more? My sensation with regard to the pyramids was, that I had seen them before. Then came a feeling of shame, that the view of them should awaken no respect. Then I wanted, naturally, to see whether my neighbors were any more enthusiastic than myself. Trinity College, Oxford, was busy with the cold ham. Downing Street was particularly attentive to a bunch of grapes. Fig Tree Court behaved with decent propriety. He is in good practice, and of a conservative turn of mind, which leads him to respect from principle less fate's accomplice. Perhaps he remembered that one of them was as big as Lincoln's Inn Fields. But, the truth is, nobody was seriously moved. And why should they, because of an exaggeration of bricks ever so enormous? I confess, for my part, that the pyramids are very big. After a voyage of about 30 hours, the steamer brought up at the quay of Balak, amidst a small fleet of dirty comfortless canjas, in which cottons and merchandise were loading and unloading, and a huge noise and bustle on the shore. Numerous villas, parks, and country houses had begun to decorate the Cairo bank of the stream near this. Residences of the Pasha's nobles, who have had orders to take their pleasure here and beautify the precincts of the capital. Tall factory chimneys also rise here. There are foundries and steam engine manufactories. These, and the pleasure houses, stand as trim as soldiers on parade, contrasting with the swarming, slovenly, close, tumble-down, eastern old town that forms the outport of Cairo and was built before the importation of European taste and discipline. Here we alighted upon donkeys, to the full as brisk as those of Alexandria, invaluable to timid riders, and equal to any weight. We had a Jerusalem pony race into Cairo, my animal beating all the rest by many lengths. The entrance to the capital, from Balak, is very pleasant and picturesque over a fair road, and the wide planted plain of the Izbekiya, where are gardens, canals, fields, and avenues of trees, and where the great ones of the town come and take their pleasure. We saw many barouches driving about with fat pashas lolling on the cushions, stately-looking colonels and doctors taking their ride, followed by their orderlies or footmen, lines of people taking pipes and sherbet in the coffee houses, and one of the pleasantest sights of all, a fine new white building with Hotel Dorian written up in huge French characters, and which, indeed, is an establishment as large and comfortable as most of the best inns of the south of France. As 100 Christian people, or more, come from England and from India every fortnight, this inn has been built to accommodate a large proportion of them, and twice a month, at least, its 60 rooms are full. The gardens from the windows give a very pleasant and animated view. The hotel gate is besieged by crews of donkey drivers. The noble stately Arab women, with tawny skins, of which a simple robe of floating blue cotton enables you liberally to see the color, and large black eyes, come to the well hard by for water. Camels are perpetually arriving and setting down their loads. The court is full of bustling dragomans, ayahs, and children from India, and poor old venerable e-nurses, with gray beards and crimson turbans, tending little white-faced babies that have seen the light at Dumdum or Fuddigar. A copper-colored barber, seated on his hams, is shaving a camel driver at the great inn gate. The bells are ringing prodigiously, and Lieutenant Waghorn is bouncing in and out of the courtyard full of business. He only left Bombay yesterday morning, was seen in the Red Sea on Tuesday, is engaged to dinner this afternoon in the Regent's Park, and as it is about 2 minutes since I saw him in the courtyard, I make no doubt he is by this time at Alexandria, or at Malta, say, perhaps, at both. Ilan is capable. If any man can be at two places at once, which I don't believe or deny, Waghorn is he. 6 o'clock bell rings. 60 people sit down to a quasi-French banquet. 30 Indian officers in mustaches and jackets, 10 civilians in ditto and spectacles, 10 pale-faced ladies with ringlets, to whom all pay prodigious attention. All the pale ladies drink pale ale, which, perhaps, accounts for it, In fact, the Bombay and Suez passengers have just arrived, and hence this crowding and bustling, and display of military jackets and mustaches, and ringlets and beauty. The windows are open, and the rush of mosquitoes from the Azbikiya waters, attracted by the wax candles, adds greatly to the excitement of the scene. There was a little tough old major, who persisted in flinging open the windows, to admit these volatile creatures, with a noble disregard to their sting, and the pale ringlets did not seem to heed them either, though the delicate shoulders of some of them were bare. All the meat, ragouts, fricandeau, and roasts, which are served round at dinner, seem to me to be of the same meat. A black uncertain sort of viand do these flesh pots of Egypt contain. But what the meat is no one knew. Is it the donkey? The animal is more plentiful than any other in Cairo. After dinner, the ladies retiring, some of us take a mixture of hot water, sugar, and pale French brandy, which is said to be deleterious, but is by no means unpalatable. One of the Indians offers a bundle of Bengal cheroots, and we make acquaintance with those honest bearded white-jacketed majors and military commanders, finding England here in a French hotel kept by an Italian, at the city of Grand Cairo, in Africa. On retiring to bed you take a towel with you into the sacred interior, behind the mosquito curtains. Then your duty is, having tucked the curtains closely around, to flap and bang violently with this towel, right and left, and backwards and forwards, until every mosquito should have been massacred, that may have taken refuge within your muslin canopy. Do what you will, however, one of them always escapes the murder, and as soon as the candle is out the miscreant begins his infernal droning and trumpeting, descends playfully upon your nose and face, and so lightly, that you don't know that he touches you. But that for a week afterwards you bear about marks of his ferocity, you might take the invisible little being to be a creature of fancy a mere singing in your ears. This, as an account of Cairo, dear M., you will probably be disposed to consider as incomplete. The fact is, I have seen nothing else as yet. I have peered into no harems. The magicians, proved to be humbugs, have been bastinadoed out of town. The dancing girls, those lovely am, of whom I had hoped to be able to give a glowing and elegant, though strictly moral, description, have been whipped into Upper Egypt, and as you are saying in your mind, well, it isn't a good description of Cairo. You are perfectly right. It is England in Egypt. I like to see her there with her pluck, enterprise, manliness, bitter ale, and Harvey sauce. Wherever they come they stay and prosper. From the summit of yonder pyramids 40 centuries may look down on them, if they are minded. And I say, those venerable daughters of time ought to be better pleased by the examination, than by regarding the French bayonets and General Bonaparte, member of the Institute, 50 years ago, running about with saber and pigtail. Wonders he did, to be sure, and then ran away, leaving Kleber, to be murdered, in the lurch a few hundred yards from the spot where these disquisitions are written. But what are his wonders compared to Waghorn? Knapp massacred the Mamelukes at the pyramids. Wag has conquered the pyramids themselves, dragged the unwieldy structures a month nearer England than they were, and brought the country along with them. All the trophies and captives that ever were brought to Roman triumph were not so enormous and wonderful as this. All the heads that Napoleon ever caused to be struck off, as George Cruikshank says, would not elevate him a monument as big. Be ours the trophies of peace. O my country! O Waghorn! Hey Tiber and Arts! When I go to the pyramids I will sacrifice in your name, and pour out libations of bitter ale and Harvey sauce in your honor. One of the noblest views in the world is to be seen from the citadel, which we ascended today. You see the city stretching beneath it, with a 1,000 minarets and mosques, the great river curling through the green plains, studded with innumerable villages. The pyramids are beyond, brilliantly distinct, and the lines and fortifications of the height, and the arsenal lying below. Gazing down, the guide does not fail to point out the famous Mameluke leap, by which one of the corps escaped death. At the time that His Highness the Pasha arranged the general massacre of the body, the venerable patriarch's harem is close by, where he received, with much distinction, some of the members of our party. We were allowed to pass very close to the sacred precincts, and saw a comfortable white European building, approached by flights of steps, and flanked by pretty gardens. Police and law courts were here also, as I understood. But it was not the time of the Egyptian assizes. It would have been pleasant, otherwise, to see the chief cadi in his hall of justice, and painful, though instructive, to behold the immediate application of the bastinado. The great lion of the place is a new mosque which Mehmed Ali is constructing very leisurely. It is built of alabaster of a fair white, with a delicate blushing tinge, but the ornaments are European, the noble, fantastic, beautiful Oriental art is forgotten. The old mosques of the city, of which I entered two, and looked at many, are a thousand times more beautiful. Their variety of ornament is astonishing, the difference in the shapes of the domes, the beautiful fancies and caprices in the forms of the minarets, which violate the rules of proportion with the most happy daring grace, must have struck every architect who has seen them. As you go through the streets, these architectural beauties keep the eye continually charmed. Now it is a marble fountain, with its arabesque and carved overhanging roof, which you can look at with as much pleasure as an antique gem, so neat and brilliant is the execution of it. Then, you come to the arched entrance to a mosque, which shoots up like what? Like the most beautiful pirouette by Taglioni, let us say. This architecture is not sublimely beautiful, perfect loveliness and calm, like that which was revealed to us at the Parthenon, and in comparison, of which the Pantheon and Colosseum are vulgar and coarse mere broad-shouldered titans before ambrosial Jove, but these fantastic spires, and cupolas, and galleries, excite, amuse, tickle the imagination, so to speak, and perpetually fascinate the eye. There were very few believers in the famous mosque of Sultan Hassan when we visited it, except the Muslim at Ishbidal, who was on the lookout for backsheesh, just like his brother officer in an English cathedral, and who, making us put on straw slippers, so as not to pollute the sacred pavement of the place, conducted us through it. It is stupendously light and airy, the best specimens of Norman art that I have seen, and surely the Crusaders must have carried home the models of these heathenish temples in their eyes, do not exceed its noble grace and simplicity. The mystics make discoveries at home, that the Gothic architecture is Catholicism carved in stone, in which case, and if architectural beauty is a criterion or expression of religion, what a dismal barbarous creed must that expressed by the Bethesda Meeting House and independent chapels be? If, as they would gravely hint, because Gothic architecture is beautiful, Catholicism is therefore lovely and right, why, Mahometanism must have been right and lovely too once. Never did a creed possess temples more elegant as the cathedral at Rouen, or the baptistery at Pisa. But it has changed now. There was nobody at prayers, only the official beadles, and the supernumerary guides, who came for backsheesh. Faith hath degenerated. Accordingly they can't build these mosques, or invent these perfect forms, anymore. Witness the tawdry incompleteness and vulgarity of the Pasha's new temple, and the woeful failures among the very late edifices in Constantinople. However, they still make pilgrimages to Mecca in great force. The Mosque of Hassan is hard by the green plain on which the Hag encamps before it sets forth annually on its pious peregrination. It was not yet its time, but I saw in the bazaars that redoubted dervish, who is the master of the Hag, the leader of every procession, accompanying the sacred camel, and a personage almost as much respected as Mr. O'Connell in Ireland. This fellow lives by alms,
I mean the head of the Hag,
Winter and Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.